You're listening to a Toronto Centre podcast. Welcome. The goal of TC Podcasts is to spread the knowledge and accumulated experience of global leaders, experts, and world-renowned specialists in financial supervision and regulation. In each episode, we'll delve into some of today's most pressing issues as it relates to financial supervision and regulation. The financial crisis, climate change, financial inclusion, fintech, and much more. Enjoy this episode.
Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to have such a distinguished group of people. We are meeting at a moment when risks to financial stability are intensifying. I don't have it all in my head. I'm reading a teleprompter, but it's all my words. Converging cyber threats, geopolitical tensions, illicit finance, and rapidly advancing technologies are increasingly intertwined, challenging supervision and policy. The added dimension today is the quantum horizon, emerging as a strategic challenge with implications for cybersecurity, financial crime, and trust. What's finance without trust? At Toronto Centre, our focus is on implementation. Since 1998, we have trained over 32,000 supervisors from 190 jurisdictions through practical programs. And why is that relevant for this conversation? A central pillar of that work is risk-based supervision. The ability to identify, prioritize, and act on risk determines supervisory effectiveness, particularly as financial crime becomes more technology-driven and cross-border. So that we spend a lot of time on that. Our work is made possible by the generous contributions of Global Affairs Canada, the Swedish CETA, IMF, and other valued partners. We're particularly pleased to have with us Giles Thompson, the incoming president of the Financial Action Task Force, reflecting the importance of linking global standard setting with real-world supervisory implementation. We're also privileged to be joined by Professor Michaela Mosca, a global leader in quantum computing, and I'm very pleased that our board of directors chair, Stefan Engbes, is here, two-time governor of the Central Bank of Sweden, and two-time chair of the Basel Committee, plus many other accomplished roles. He's bringing deep experience across monetary policy, financial stability, and standard setting. This conversation will be guided by our expert moderator and our board member, who also, works at the MCM at IMF, right? Okay, part-time, it's not so much part-time. This is also, by the way, a development issue. It's not just a supervisory issue, because it supports stability, inclusion, and trust, especially in emerging markets and developing economies. In that sense, building supervisory capacity is central to economic resilience, which brings me to our opening speaker. It is my great pleasure to introduce the Cindy Temmers-Wyson, Canada's Deputy Minister of International Development, who was recently appointed to this role. But she brings with her a vast experience in Canada's foreign affairs policy, including as a former associate deputy minister and deep involvement with G7 and G20. Cindy, we are honored to have you with us today and wonder if I could come to the podium for a few moments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Babak, and just delighted to be here with you this afternoon. Bon après-midi à toutes et à tous. Thank you so much for having me here to open this important discussion. I'd like to thank the Toronto Centre for hosting this panel and for bringing together such an eminent group of leaders and experts during the IMF and World Bank spring meetings. The Toronto Centre provides high-quality capacity-building programs and guidance for financial supervisors and regulators, primarily in developing countries, to advance financial stability and inclusion. I also want to acknowledge our moderator, Jennifer Elliott, and our panelists, Stefan Engbes, Giles Thompson, and Michaela Mosca. Thank you for your leadership and for sharing your experience with us today. Canada is proud of our long history and partnership with the Toronto Centre. It was created in 1988 with Canada's support, and the Centre has ever since played an important role in strengthening financial systems around the world. The Toronto Centre has helped regulators and supervisors build skills, confidence and networks that support stability and growth. This work reflects a key Canadian priority. Strong institutions matter. Sound rules matter. And people benefit when financial systems are stable, trusted, and inclusive. The topic of today's panel is very timely. Around the world, technology is changing how financial systems work. Digital tools are moving faster. New products are reaching people more quickly. And new forms of risk are emerging all the time. Cyber threats are growing. Systems are more connected. And when systems fail, the impacts can spread quickly. These risks affect all countries, but they can be harder to manage where resources and experience are limited. That's why preparation matters. And that is why sharing knowledge matters. Now, the idea of the quantum era can sound a bit abstract to some, especially with all of the headlines about AI in the papers right now. But waiting until problems are fully visible is often too late. Countries need to prepare early, stay flexible, and work together. As financial systems modernize, protection must keep pace. Supervisory authorities will need enhanced skills, tools, and risk-based approaches to detect, mitigate, and respond to cyber attacks, operational disruptions, and evolving forms of financial threat. New tools and new ideas are welcome, but they need to be surrounded by clear rules, strong oversight, and good judgment. Innovation works best when people trust the system behind it, as Babak just said. And no country can manage these risks on their own. Cyber and operational risks do not stop at borders. A weakness in one place can affect many others. And so this is why cooperation between governments, regulators, international institutions, universities, and the private sector is so important. Open dialogue and shared learning help make better decisions. Building capacity is essential. Many countries want to strengthen their financial systems, but need support to do so. So training, peer learning, and long-term partnerships can turn good intentions into real change. And institutions like the Toronto Centre play a critical role in this work. They help regulators ask the right questions, spot problems early, and respond with confidence. And these efforts are essential not only to safeguard domestic financial systems, but also to ensure that countries can fully and safely participate in global markets, support stable investment environments, and maintain financial integrity in an increasingly complex landscape. Canada continues to support this work. Through our partnership with the Toronto Centre, we are investing in stronger supervision, better risk management, and more resilient institutions, especially in emerging economies. This is not only the right thing to do, it also supports global stability, which benefits us all. So I'd like to close by thanking once again the Toronto Centre for convening this important panel, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup.
So thank you very much for your comments. I set a very strong, set the stage for a very strong conversation. So without further ado, Jennifer, I'm going to hand the panel to you. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm going to give the first question to Giles and jump right in. You're the incoming FATF president. Big job. Congratulations. How do you see the convergence of cybercrime, illicit finance, and geopolitical uncertainty in terms of financial sector risk and what's coming? And then maybe a little bit about how the international framework responds to that.
Okay. No, thank you. And thank you very much for the invitation. I mean, just in case anyone's not familiar, the Financial Action Task Force is the global anti-money laundering standard setter. And so we set the standards for countries to follow. We assess them against it. And then we help educate in terms of typologies, best practice, threats, and so on. You know, I think what we're seeing at the global level is, you know, increasingly that illicit finance, illicit financial flows are cross-border by default. They're happening faster, increasing cyber enablingness of crime. We're also seeing increasingly that geopolitical instability can feed into furthering illicit financial flows. You know, in countries where you have conflicts, where you have breakdown of governance, you often will find increasing crime, increasing illicit finance risks, and so on. I mean, just to give a few examples from some of the recent work we're doing, looking at fraud, for instance, you know, you see relatively ungoverned spaces operating in parts of the world, in Southeast Asia and elsewhere, where, you know, huge scam compounds are being run as effective mini economies in and of themselves that are defrauding people on a massive scale across many countries of the world, as well as subjecting the people working within them to, you know, modern slavery, human trafficking and abuse as well. We're seeing the growth of AI and technology presenting like ever more challenging threats, both on fraud, where, you know, people, fraudsters can use AI to, you know, groom people for investment fraud, to interact with them over the phone, over the internet and so on, to get them to invest in scams. We're seeing that change the whole concept of how the anti-money laundering industry thinks about doing customer due diligence, which increasingly had been moving online, being able to be authenticated over a phone, over an app. And now people are increasingly worrying about the use of deep fakes and other ways of getting around that, and whether you're almost going to have to go back to a world of, you know, face-based, paper-based customer due diligence to deal with it. You know, we're seeing hostile state actors intrinsically involved in ransomware, you know, cyber theft. We've had instances of national banks in some countries losing huge sums of money from cyber theft that has been linked to hostile state actors. And we're seeing increasingly, you know, growth of cross-border international money laundering networks who are offering illicit finance, financial crime services as a business. You know, using, operating across borders, often operating from jurisdictions unwilling to curtail their activities or unable to curtail their activities. And I mean, an old colleague of mine who used to work in UK law enforcement used to say that, you know, probably a good metric for measuring the success of the fight against money laundering is the commission that money launderers are charging for laundering your money. You know, and I don't like to do that, because on that metric, I think we're really struggling. I think, you know, it used to be in the UK, you know, more in the region of 10 to 20% people will be charged, and it's now down in single digits because of the sort of like the automation or the business model that the criminals are using to enable them to launder money, which is a sort of sobering reminder of the threat. Trying to be more optimistic in terms of, you know, what we can do about it at the FATF level. So, you know, I think some of our strengths as an organisation are partly the global reach. We're 40 members in the FATF, but we have a global network of over 200 countries who adhere to the standards we work with. We've got some of the representatives in the room of the regional bodies of FATF who work with us. And that power to work across borders. And, you know, I would like to think that despite an era of probably, you know, incredibly challenging geopolitical uncertainty, the FATF has, as a technical body focused on some common threats, managed to keep its work going, to keep moving, to keep working. We've published over the last year or so some major reports on terrorist financing, on proliferation financing, both subjects that have no shortage of geopolitical tension around them, but we've managed to keep working on those as a technical community. And secondly, we managed to convene like law enforcement, policymakers, regulators, and often the private sector together to work on these and to try and fashion common solutions. And I think, you know, increasingly that relationship, both with supervisors, law enforcement, but also with the private sector in tackling some of these threats is key, and having that closer relationship. And just finally, a couple of areas where, you know, I think what we're trying to do illustrates the way we're needing to be more nimble to deal with fast evolving events. You know, we're doing a lot of work on the AML regulation of crypto assets, as well as reforming our payment transparency standards, recommendation 16, as we call it, for cross-border payments. And on those, you know, what we're trying to do is, rather than sort of going away into our sort of government bunker for years and working on something, is work iteratively with the private sector, who are seeing these threats day to day in real time on how we're evolving our standard, our interpretation of it, and our implementation of it. And we have contact groups that meet regularly with industry, with supervisors, with law enforcement to get that instant feedback.
So you started by bringing together all the different risks, and then you ended with all of the different people who have to be involved in trying to solve that, which is a nice segue to the technology. So Michaela, you are our expert on quantum computing. It's not often we have a quantum computing expert on the stage of the IMF. It's great to have you. My understanding of the risk of quantum computing is speed and the speed of decrypting. And my second understanding is that speed is speeding up. So maybe you can tell us what all of that means for financial sector risk and some of the things that Giles has laid out.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. So it's a little even broader than that, right? So all the digital systems and platforms we use and the mechanisms to protect them, their confidentiality is obviously critical, but more and more importantly, their availability, their integrity, authenticity, like the integrity of ledgers and so on, availability of financial systems, the control of connected devices, AI agents, right, integrity of AI models, all protected by cryptography and the same small set of mathematical algorithms. So these protections, let's assume that they're perfectly well designed and perfectly implemented. All that security only holds if the assumptions hold, right? And those assumptions, it's hyper-concentrated across all of our platforms. So we worry about vendor concentration, worry about supply chain risk. This is hyper-concentration. If those algorithms are broken, so for example, auto updates, right? That if somebody sends you a payload that looks like an update of your operating system, they can now own whatever system accepted that auto update, right? So it's really also about the control of systems and the how much you can actually trust your trusted suppliers if they're using the same cryptographic algorithms. And it's not just isolated failure, it's systemic. It's hard to detect because they have the digital master key. Like digitally, they are your vendor as far as you're concerned. That's a lot worse than some shady way to get into your supply chain, to compromise your supply chain. So it's hard to detect, right? And attribute, like they have the digital master key. Like who was it? I don't know. Right? And what are you supposed to do about it if an assumption fails? Right? Unless you've proactively prepared to be ready for a foundational break. And we know how to do that, but the history of humanity, we generally don't prepare. We wait for something bad to happen. And so you might be wondering, what does quantum have to do with this, right? So one of the assumptions underlying the security of these codes is that certain mathematical problems are hard to solve. And we assumed the computers available were not leveraging the laws of quantum physics. Now, the laws of quantum physics, we didn't invent them because we were bored. We invented them because they were observable phenomena that were impossible, but they were happening, so they're not impossible. And so we invented a new framework for physics to explain those things. And over the past century, we've moved from observing and understanding to building technologies that can control matter in this quantum mechanical way. And we can engineer our own previously impossible things. So now, we can sense things that were previously not possible, and the military very much cares about that. We can also, on the positive side, protect things in environments where previously would be impossible. But we can also solve computational problems with astronomically fewer steps. Some of them, not any one, but a handful, and we're just scratching the surface and understanding some problems astronomically faster, because it's with astronomically fewer steps. And it just so happens, serendipitously, that one of the first problems where we saw this happen was the mathematical codes underpinning the digital economy today, the codes that allowed the last 30 years of economic growth. So that's a problem. We need to get ahead of it. If this gets weaponized, 15 years ago, saying we need to get ahead of this, otherwise long-term confidential information could be recorded and eventually broken. I wasn't really talking about operational failures. But now, the timeline to having a working quantum computer, like we had 30 years of cloud, high variance, high mean, high expected time, high variance, uncertainty. I was following it like very closely, so I could see it moving. But for most of us, it's like we don't really know, and we don't know, you know, how long it'll be. We're now just in the last few months, you know, last couple years, I've been in this new phase where the expected time to having a working quantum computer that can break these codes is much smaller and the variance is tighter. And once we get one, you only need a kilobyte of quantum bits to break these codes, not a gigabyte, not a megabyte. So some quantum Moore's law is not going to save us. Like, we're already in the we might be too late period. So when should I start? Like, long time ago. Like, we're now, don't worry, you're not going to be early. The question is, how late are we going to be to really get, you know, internalize this real material systemic risk and get ahead of it?
Okay, so we'll come back to this, what can we do later, yeah, maybe, and when, yeah, we get to Stefan. But just as a side question, everybody's read the news about Anthropic and Mythos. And so how do you connect those two things, quantum and AI risk? Do they work together? Is there anything positive in some of this?
Yeah, I'll get to the positive stuff later. Oh. But they're very different things, but they actually do interplay in very powerful, like, multiplicative ways. For one, AI is accelerating the timeline to have a quantum computer. We use it to design them, implement them, program them, improve the algorithm, you know. So it's accelerating the timeline. And just some more bad news. Like, we have certain algorithms that break today's codes. We're racing to replace them with new codes. Those could be broken too, right? And AI is accelerating the discovery of new code-breaking mechanisms. Quantum is another weapon that could be used to break the new codes as well as the current codes. So this is still more bad news. And when there is a vulnerability, right? So with the Anthropic thing, that's about bad implementations of good designs are already killing us and could, like, be a very, very, like, we'll see in the next few weeks and months how bad it's going to be. Bad designs are worse, because then what do you do about that? We know how to fix a buffer overflow and so on, but not, easier said than done, and it's very dangerous. Design mistakes are even worse. An assumption mistake is even more catastrophic. So the AI is accelerating, it just makes it even worse than what we're hearing about from Anthropic right now. So because the weaponization and scaling of the attacks will be even faster now because of AI. So the exciting new phase of AI means we have to accelerate our quantum readiness plans, not, you know, set them aside for later. It's like, no, you need to accelerate that. And again, the happy story is we really want to benefit from the positive things that AI and quantum brings. And in order to do that, a prerequisite is to make sure we're resilient to weaponizations of them. And we actually know how to do it. It's not hard, but, you know, there's been obviously in the history of humanity a market failure there when it comes to being proactive about these sorts of things.
Great segue to Stefan, who is used to thinking about bad news. So Stefan, thinking about you've lived through a few crises and you've done central banking for a long time. At what point does what Michaela has set out for you become a systemic event, and how do we prepare for that?
Well, first of all, money is a convention. Money is about what we have in our heads. And then technologies change over time, and then that becomes a dilemma. In addition to that, we're sort of used to think about money or monies, using the plural, in a very sort of physical sense, something you can touch. And all of a sudden you cannot, and then we have this technical evolution, and then we need to translate that into something bad happening. And the bad thing happening today is not really a line of people standing outside a branch office of a bank wanting their physical cash. It's much more likely that you try to log on to your bank and it doesn't exist anymore the way you know it. Or a milder version of this is that somehow mysteriously somebody else has emptied your account and the money is simply not there. And then what do you do and how do you deal with that? And that creates an environment which is not that dissimilar actually from what they have prepared for and manage in some sense in Ukraine today. Because all of a sudden you might find yourself running a bank in a situation where you actually have to go to your competitors and say, could you please handle the backup system of all my accounts? And then the banks actually have to cooperate in that environment so that, and I'm saying this in a very positive way, but it sounds negative. You've got to have a shadow bank so that you can operate this thing without your own bank actually being available, at least for some time, so that you can recreate this. This becomes, of course, even more difficult to deal with, and probably more so from an FATF perspective, if we're talking about distributed ledger, and particularly a permissionless distributed ledger, because then you can call yourself Donald Duck and you can do all sorts of not so nice stuff, and that increases actually the demands on the supervisors and the administrators when you have to protect yourself doing these things. And I think it's just a matter of time before this happens somewhere in the world, that all of a sudden your bank, the way you know it in IT space, just does not exist because something bad has happened. And how do you then recreate that so that you can get your money back?
Okay, the plate of central bankers and supervisors just gets heavier and heavier. We're gonna do one more round and then we'll come to your questions out there. Back to you, Giles, thinking about the FATF and technology risk that we've heard about. What's the thinking at the FATF about moving forward, and how can you help members? You're doing two things, right? You're convening and then you're setting standards, which kind of has a ripple effect to bring everybody up to speed and force them to think about all these things. So what's happening at the FATF?
Yeah, so I mean, I think overall, we need to focus on consistent implementation of the standards we have across the world so that, you know, we don't have regulatory fragmentation or weak spots and gaps. And that's a big focus as we go through what we call our fifth round of peer reviews or evaluations. But we're also conscious we need to keep those standards evolving and ready to adapt where necessary. And we need to keep on top of the new threats and the evolving threats and ensure that, you know, we're up to date and we're sharing and communicating information rapidly with our members and also with the private sector. I think sort of a couple of additional points, you know, I would weave into that is, you know, one, I think our universe of stakeholders that we engage with as a financial crime community needs to expand and is expanding. So, you know, traditionally we have a set of, you know, regulated entities, as we call them, which is the banks, largely lawyers, accountants, and so on. Increasingly, when you're looking at, for instance, fraud as a financial crime threat, there's a much bigger universe of actors that need to be involved in the response and our work. And we're increasingly talking to and engaging with the tech sector, you know, the big tech firms, the telco sectors, because, you know, by and large, a lot of the financial crime, the fraud, the scams are happening on online platforms or using, you know, telephone networks and so on. And so I think, you know, we'll really try and shift towards focusing on the evolving threats coming, in particular from fraud, in particular from, you know, cryptocurrencies and new and evolving threats. So, you know, the growth of stablecoin, what does that mean for AML/CTF, potential central bank digital currencies? What does that mean? The growth of, you know, peer-to-peer payments, platforms, decentralized finance, and how we can keep on top of those threats. I think information sharing is going to be a key priority for us over the next 2 years to tackle these threats. And by that, we mean, you know, making sure that countries can share information rapidly, both within countries, between public and private sector. You know, most of the information on financial crime tends to sit in the private sector. On what's happening, the public sector might know the bad guys or the criminal entities that they're worried about, but actually what they're doing and how they're moving money is not going to largely sit with the public sector. So you need to join those up and make sure people are sharing information. We are going to try and promote the use of technology by countries and by financial sectors in how they tackle financial crime threats to try and keep up pace with the threat. And that's, you know, an important part of our work on the risk-based approach that we will do with supervisors as well, is to ensure, firstly, we're promoting supervisors using technology to enable them to identify risk, you know, more accurately, more rapidly within their supervised population, and that we're also ensuring that private firms are encouraged to innovate and use technology and don't perceive the regulator, the supervisor, or the standard setter as a barrier to developing innovative new financial crime management systems that are more effective at detecting the threats.
Okay, thanks. Michaela, I'm going to go back to you because Giles has laid out many things that need to be happening on the part of supervisors, but thinking about banks and financial institutions, because their supervisors are going to ask more from them, they need to up their game. What's the biggest thing they should be thinking about right now?
We have to move from managing cryptographic assets and tools to managing cryptographic risk. You'll hear, like, everyone's like, oh yeah, we're dealing with quantum. And if you hear what they're talking about, it's all technical gobbledygook. And it's about better managing their cryptographic assets. Congratulations, you have the right assets. Are they sufficient? And so on and so on. We got to elevate it into translating cryptograph, internalize it, and manage it the way we're managing all our other, you know, high order risks for the bank. And we know how to do it. So we will solve the technology problem, but this hyper concentration risk, like Stefan mentioned, for example, have a backup bank. So that's a form of defense in depth at the business layer. Of course, that doesn't work if all the banks are down. So you need some defense in depth at the cryptography layer. Not everywhere. You can't put everything in a vault, right? And it's hard. It's got to be red team, blue team, so to speak. And there's got to be some iterations and challenging and working through scenarios to build up confidence that we've properly managed cryptographic risk alongside all the other ones. Because I know we have finite resources and finite attention spans, but we certainly can't ignore this one because it's, you know, potentially game over situation if this gets ahead of us. And again, AI is just exacerbating. It's reducing the timeline to react. Like, forget about hoping. Like, hope and luck is not a strategy. Like, you can't hope to get an advance warning of this. You just have to architect. So if a cryptographic algorithm is broken, it will suck, but we will survive. But we're not there yet.
So one thing you said earlier was, which struck me, was the concentration of all this, which is a,
yeah.
Is there a solution to that?
Yeah, it's the same solution, you know, for millennia, right? For concentration, you have diversity. You have to have a few, by diversity, I don't mean 1,000 different garbage options, a small set of truly different, well-vetted, standardized, and we're in a Washington like NIST and like this strong global standards, but a diversity of them. And this has to be managed by grown-ups because the technical people, they all really love their one way of doing things and they'll tell you to ignore the others. We need a small handful of others. So diversity, agility, right? So we have to move a little faster. How much agility? Again, that has to be risk-based. Technology people, you'll build an armored car for everything. So we have to, in a risk-based way, decide how much agility we need, which changes because use cases change, threat models change, assumptions change. So we have to be ready to reassess rapidly. And then where necessary, defense in depth. You can't overdo it, but you know, right now we need the diversity because defense in depth with the same thing doesn't help either. So you need those three things, diversity, agility, and defense in depth. We know how to do it. We just need risk governance to steer us to the sufficient level of resilience.
Okay, so then we'll take risk governance to Stefan then. So Stefan, As Michaela laid out, and also Giles is laying out sort of advanced expectations, a lot for supervisors to think about. Do you see blind spots there, and what would those be in managing all of this?
Well, usually you find the blind spots ex post, and that's a dilemma in itself. But there is a sort of a learning process in that. So you ideally deal with small blind spots and you sort of learn from that. But starting from a different angle and when it comes to sort of the money aspects of this and usually when we talk about the financial sector, particularly banks, we talk a lot about credit risk. We talk a lot about liquidity risk. And then we have this sort of amorphous term called operational risk, but no one really knows what it means. And this is really about how you fill that term with content. And that content actually requires completely new competences on the supervisory side. So we're actually going to have to add, let's say, groups of individuals with a very, very different competence profile. compared to what you have had in the past and what you have focused on. Because if you have, it doesn't really matter to the customers of a bank if you close the bank because there was a lot of credit risk, or if everything just disappeared somewhere in cyberspace. In both cases, you can't get your money back. But in terms of what you, how you organize yourself on the supervisory side or on the central banking side, because this is a central issue if you run a central bank as well, because central banks more or less all over the world actually control the payment system. And that's really the core of the whole thing when it comes to moving money around. And that means that all of a sudden you realize, if you're the governor of a central bank, that I know what a Taylor equation looks like, but what do I know about this? And then I have to add completely new sort of competences to my organization. And that's a challenge.
Do you think, I mean, Giles was mentioning the public-private partnership a bit, and it's also the technology, private sector larger than the financial institutions, also technology. Do you see that happening more? I think we do see it in cyber happening more, where banks are a bit more open with supervisors about their own challenges and so on, because everybody's sort of in it together. Do you see that with quantum, with because the speed at which it's moving, is it going to be hard for supervisors to have that dialogue? Is there an adversarial thing happening here? Or is it something that we really truly would be open and working together and just thinking about crisis preparation and whether, you know, the armored car of technology is going to be demanded and then, you know, banks will push back? How do you see that dynamic?
You just have to cooperate as best and as much as you possibly can. And I do think that the plumbers in this business are aware of this, both on the public sector side and on the private sector side. Because on the private sector side, there is an awareness today that if you don't manage this, then your bank can kind of almost disappear overnight. And that means that you actually have to get together within the banking community, regardless of where you are, and think about how to do this. I'm not saying that we have figured out actually how to do it. Mm-hmm. So there is an awareness of it. But ideally, we need a few minor accidents that we can learn from.
Well, oh, survivable ones.
Oh, Michaela has a view on that minor accident. Go
I want
ahead.
Them to be survivable. Yeah. That's a great point, because it's actually a three-party problem that I've seen in the market, in that, you know, the vendors don't have the solutions available. Why? Because the customers aren't asking. The banks aren't asking. Why aren't the banks asking? Well, you know, we don't have to, basically. We're not being guided, whether that's a question of showing the light or providing the heat. I'll be agnostic, but they're not being guided by the regulators, who aren't. And one of the reasons the regulators aren't acting is, well, the solutions aren't available. We can't possibly require things that aren't available. So there's a bit of a tripartite dilemma that we need to, it's a downward spiral. I think we need to turn it into an upward spiral, but it has to be a respectful discussion amongst the three stakeholders there.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Thank you very much, all three of you. I think that's opened the floor. People surely have questions. Lady in the front row, right off the bat. It's right there.
Okay. Hello, I'm Dr. IG, private sector, expert in artificial intelligence. I have a question. We are talking about the danger of quantum computing to destroy data. But here's the thing. Isn't it supposed there are two types of encryption? That which is the public encryption, which is more vulnerable to what is called symmetric encryption, which is very much more difficult to break. And also, in order for the bad actors to do that, they definitely need a very highly fast and very high quality quantum computer to do that. But as far as I know, quantum computer is not there yet in the sense of being so powerful to do that, because the problem of the qubit's stability that yet has not been solved by private sector, unless you take only a couple of qubits, then you can do very high quality analysis. That's a point. Now, on the other hand, isn't it supposed that the bad actors, there's a slogan that says harvest now and decrypt later. And apparently what we need to do is what is the private sector is already proposing is to create a post-quantum encryption. I mean, post-quantum cryptography such that we can build much more powerful algorithms in order to be used them now before these bad guys keep harvesting everybody's data. So I guess my question is, how can the not just the private sector, but everybody really be alert and protecting the data? Because once that powerful quantum computer comes, then anything that is no public, well, that is public, is going to be easily vulnerable rather than the symmetric one. Can you go around that?
I was trying to avoid not getting too technical, but maybe I didn't get technical enough.
It's more the approach.
But those are good points, so I think I can address them. So I did mention, like, the harvest now, decrypt later. So even if quantum computers are many years in the future, it's a problem. But what I really need to emphasize, I mean, I was among the first to bring that message out 10, 15 years ago. But I do think in terms of having a computer large enough to break that, I think there's a 10 to 15% chance it happens in 5 years and a 45% chance in 10 years. And a lot of that probability is systemic, right? So it's well above the 1 in 1,000 threshold for Basel III and whatever. So we do need to get ahead of it. And I do think the bigger losses are the operational losses and integrity and loss of control and so on. Losing confidentiality is bad, but I think loss of confidence is probably going to be a bigger cost. So that's sort of on the second part of your question. And I guess I didn't mean to convey that all cryptography is broken and we're all going to die necessarily. We might, I don't know. But there's a handful of cryptographic algorithms. And so before public key cryptography, which, as I think I mentioned, enabled the last 30 years of economic growth, what did I mean by that? It allowed us to protect the internet scalably. For millennia before that, it was somebody manually exchanging keys, using symmetric key methods, right? Quantum doesn't really break the known symmetric key methods. Could it break them? Maybe. I would say an order of magnitude less likely than breaking the public key methods. Public key is this magic that allows us to protect open, scalable systems. It allows us to do two things. Sign things. We can attest to the integrity and authenticity of things. And it allows us to replace the person with a briefcase manually exchanging keys with mathematical algorithms. So it's much more functional, beautiful, scalable, higher mathematical risk. So it's beautiful, so it's the public key that's at stake. And indeed, you know, there's lots of defense in depth. It's not like if I give you, you know, somebody's secret key, it's not like you can take over the global financial system overnight or steal trillions of dollars. There's many other things you have to get through. But if you give adversaries such a powerful weapon as a digital master key that is, again, hard to detect, hard to attribute, like, we don't know the limits of the playbooks they'll come up with. So it's not, because some people will be very cavalier and like, I don't know how I would use it. Well, okay, but you're not the guy I'm worried about. There's smarter, more capable people than you that know what they're doing, right? Because often you'll need an insider combined with this capability can take you down. And I don't have an insider, but there's certainly people who do, right? And then so with the adoption of any innovation, the first thing you do is just speed up your current playbooks. So adversaries will just accelerate their existing kill chains and so on. But then they'll realize, wait a minute, I have a digital master key. I don't even need an insider or whatever. The economics of cybercrime, like we're talking about 10% to 1%, it might be 0.1%. Like, it starts to change the economics of cybercrime in a way that is unpredictable. Unpredictable not in the sense of, oh, maybe it won't happen. No, it's unpredictable in the sense, I asked somebody, former head of, you know, one of the leaders of an intelligence agency, how do you think they're going to weaponize the ability to get a private key? And he's like, well, whatever you think of, it'll be a lot worse. So we just need to get ahead of it.
And the tricky thing about the financial sector, right, is it doesn't need to be, it's trust. It's what Cindy said in her opening. And you can chip away at trust without.
Well, hybrid war is all about,
Okay, sorry. Front row and then Ezio.
Thank you, Daniel, International Monetary Fund. The title of our panel contains words about a geopolitical conflict. So my question may be to Giles. To Giles, more related to how do you assess in the era of AI the efficiency of sanctions as an instrument, and how do you see the shape of the race between sanctions and sanctions evasions, and how it is all like aided by these new instruments, including crypto, AI, and so on.
Yeah, no, thank you. So within the Financial Action Task Force, as well as anti-money laundering standards, we also set standards for what we call targeted financial sanctions, covering UN proliferation and terrorism regimes. And we actually published a report a year or so ago looking at some up-to-date indicators of what's happening on proliferation financing. And I think you will see in that, what I was talking about earlier in terms of the confluence of a lot of different types of criminality. So like what we might see as a threat to the implementation of counter-proliferation sanctions on DPRK, is also similar networks used to involved in other criminality, be it cybercrime or, trafficking other illicit goods. So kind of increasing confluence. In terms of the AI technology, I think what we're particularly conscious of at the FATF in terms of the threat to implementation of those sanctions regimes is cryptocurrency being used as a way of avoiding sanctions, and that operating almost as, in some ways, as a parallel system for getting around some of those. So that, I think, would probably be the primary threat that we're conscious of.
Okay. Can we have a microphone here?
Thank you. I am Ezio from the World Bank, and my question is for the former chair of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. You mentioned operational risk. Do you think the capital requirements for operational risk are adequate?
That you only know ex post. Because it's just so hard, and one needs to be mindful of the fact that basically, the Basel Committee is more or less a global organization where you have to agree on something. And to agree on something, that doesn't mean that you necessarily optimize things, because people have so different views on what you ought to do. So it's a kind of a second best. And I remember when we were dealing with this, that it was an enormous struggle just to come up with a number. And it was very, very difficult for one very basic reason, which is what I touched on earlier. All of a sudden, you talk to completely different people with a different mindset and a completely different background. And that makes it very hard when compromises have to be made in one way or the other, because it's also the ultimate decision makers, speaking about myself and others, aren't really comfortable with that type of issues, because you're dealt, as I said earlier, with credit risk and other types of risks. But it's not only about capital, because it doesn't. I mean, let's suppose for the sake of the argument that we have a 100% capital charge. You can only lend your own. You just can lend not very much. But then ultimately, at the end of the day, it becomes an issue of trust. And it doesn't matter so much what the numbers happen to be if you have lost trust. And then that's really, really difficult to deal with. And that's why, by the way, it's so hard when you have to deal with these things, regardless of what created the problem in the first place, because if you really seriously mismanage how you deal with a small bank going under, you always risk losing trust for the system as a whole, because it sort of sends the signal that these people don't know what they're doing. And then should I sit and wait for the next case, or should I just get out? I just don't have a good sort of the perfect answer to it, but I'm pretty sure that the issue will come back. And it's, of course, it's really, really difficult because what really drives the private sector is return on equity. And the ultimate driver in this is to get capital down, not capital up. And sometimes it goes down too much.
Okay, related to Pent, I'm going to abuse my privilege for a second. Related to that, capital is not the answer. Supervision's got to be the answer, right? And we're right now living in a time where there's significant pressure to reduce supervisory resources, at least not increase them, in keeping with the complexity here. You guys have talked a little bit about the technology knowledge needs and technology understanding needs. What do we do to make it more of a priority to make sure that those people holding the purse strings understand that it's not going to be about adding capital? It's going to be about people putting the pressure on other people to keep up with things. What do we do?
My naive attempt at it is to try to articulate, we're not trying to protect the Ferrari because we're scaredy cats, is that we want to drive the car really fast. So we want this resilience, because if your systems aren't trustworthy, you have two options. You don't trust them, and then you don't create the value. Or you do trust them, but you're playing Russian roulette, and it could all evaporate. And so, but if you build it to be trustworthy, a risk-based way, because I mean, you still have to make the Ferrari light, but you also want to make it safe so you can survive a crash. And so it's really about enabling all the wealth creation and problem solving that AI, quantum, and everything else enables, but in a way that doesn't create this existential threat for the global economy. That's what I try. Haven't been successful yet, but it tends to resonate a little more than just talk about, you know, security and all the threats and doom and gloom, and make it clear, or I use a hockey analogy because I'm from Canada, but I guess this, it'll work in Sweden too, right? Like, you wear padding not because you're a chicken, it's because you want to play aggressive and score a lot of goals. Because without padding, you're not going to focus on scoring goals. You're going to be scared to get hit by the puck or a stick or whatever. So it's really just enough padding so you can aggressively go and create value and do all the exciting things we want to do, but survive it and not be too scared. And again, not bring the risk to zero, because that's too expensive, but bring it to 1 in 1,000, whatever the risk tolerance is. Get it below that threshold and then focus on all the exciting value creation. That's what I try.
That's a great argument. Okay, questions? I have one at the back.
Rex Wimpen, Orchestra AI. I wanted to ask if you would comment on a possible solution which has been touted now, and that is quantum encryption. And if you believe this is viable, then could it be instantiated in the blockchain? Thank you.
So in this technology in the hands of the good guys, Is that the answer?
So there's quantum encryption in the literal sense of using quantum communication and quantum technology to protect. I think adds, remember I mentioned diversity earlier? That's something to add to the, like one other, not 20,000 really bad protocols, but enabling, because there's quantum key exchange and so on, I think enabling that alongside the other measures is preparing for success in the future, because it gives us another way that is very different from the other ways. So I think it's very important to nurture it and bring it toward being a usable, certifiable, standards-based solution, absolutely. And there's post-quantum, which is, it's uses regular technology, but it's designed to be secure against quantum attack. That's table stakes. Like, we shouldn't even be talking about algorithms that are known to be broken by quantum computers. People still do, but they're going to eventually, as Max Planck said, you know, new ideas don't replace old ones, because proponents of the new ideas convince proponents of the old ideas. Proponents of the old ideas die off. And eventually all that's left is, you know, proponents of the new idea. So we're getting there. And so everything's going to be post-quantum by design. But I agree with you that, but what's not true is like, oh, maybe we don't need to do this post-quantum migration because quantum networks are going to save us. No, like that's a super naive, experts would be like, nobody thinks that. But like sometimes actually those messages do come across because it can get a little complicated. So it's part of the solution, but we do need to like very aggressively migrate and urgently to these post-quantum algorithms, because they will stop the known threats. And then quantum networks and so on can help us be more immune against the unknown unknowns of the future, which we know are coming. I don't know what they are, but they're definitely coming.
Mr. Das, front row.
So I have a question for Mr. Thompson. So in light of all this, I'm thinking the definition that FATF has of illicit flows, is it ready to be changed or should it be redefined? Because we are talking about a lot of things that are going to change, the speed, the scale, and maybe even the types of illicit flows. So any thought on that?
So, I mean, we for the purposes of what we do, we will see, illicit flows as things that flow from a crime being committed. And that's, in terms of our framework, for our standards to apply, you're dealing with money being laundered, i.e. crimes being committed. So, from that perspective, I'm not entirely sure from the angle of the question what you think doesn't hold true potentially in the future on that.
Okay, so no, my question was that, look, this is all very transformative.
Yeah.
The stuff that is going on. So I think I'm looking at it from that angle, that complexity will go up, speed will go up. Yes, maybe quantum computing might help to solve the complexity problems for a banker in terms of flows. But just wanted to get that inside FATF, is there any thinking being given that in light of all this, the definition, the illicit flows definition is fairly old. And in light of the ways in which these flows take place and by who and by what method, it is going to change. It is likely to change. So is FATF thinking forward on this or?
Thank you. We're certainly thinking of the ways in which, the threats, the flows are changing, as I talked about, the way in which, we're seeing fraud evolve, the way in which we're seeing misuse of virtual assets, cryptocurrencies evolve, and trying to keep pace with the evolving risks, the evolving threats and what we're seeing. I think our challenge is to ensure that our standards, continue to be applicable. I mean, the standards are designed to be, apply across all different sorts of crime threats, all different flows, and where there are particular risks and challenges, we have to try and adapt to that. So most recently, we're changing the way we require information to be shared on cross-border transfers, payment transfers, just because the world has moved on significantly. And where that happens, our challenge is to keep pace with that and the evolving world. In terms of the sort of actual concept of the definition of illicit flows, no, that's not like currently on the radar per se.
Question back here.
Good afternoon. Dama Isialagan from Young Diplomats of Canada. I had a question more so for Mr. Mosca. So you talked about this tripartite gridlock between the vendors, the regulators, and the central banks. My question is, where are we seeing a lot of the impetus or the catalyzation for the discussions to improve regulation and the cooperation between the three parties? And where ideally would we like to see more effort being put in?
So there hasn't been a lot of impetus. The little bit of impetus there has been has largely been in spite of the system, not because of the system. So most of the forces work against this proactive preparation. But fortunately, there's half crazy academics who do things because it's interesting and because they believe in it, even though, so that got us. That's why we only reason we have some algorithms, so that when the NSA, so one positive glimmer of hope is the NSA in the United States in 2015, and I've been proselytizing this since 96, right? And they said, okay, we're migrating to post-quantum algorithms as soon as possible. And they got a lot of grief for that. But they did a really good thing for the whole world. And NIST had been preparing several years for that day and launched a standards program that ran almost 10 years. It's a global effort, right? It was coordinated by the US, but most of the work was done in Europe and Canada and even Asia and other parts. But so it was a great success story in spite of the market forces. It made a big deal because credible authorities start saying something, people take it more seriously when the academics or other people are saying it. It doesn't carry so much weight with as many people. So those are a few of the glimmers of hope. So as more regulators, we now have, the financial regulators have been sending signals, OSFI, the MAS, right, and WEF and other organizations in this space have been doing things and sending signals. And that helps move things along. We just need to do more of it faster. And at the same time, say, like, because if this ever happens again, we're not going to get 30 years of advance warning. So figure out, great question. So what worked this time and how can we go faster and be proactively ready for unannounced cryptographic failures? Because we're not going to have it, you know, with AI and so on, we're not going to have that advance warning. Anyway, that's a couple examples of what worked, but most of it was in spite of the market forces.
Thank you. Yeah.
Let me just add to that, that the NIST approach, if I use that as an example, is a good one because it actually forces you to ask yourself, where am I? How do I position myself compared to some kind of evolving best practice?
Yeah.
And that's a good way of going about.
Yeah, I also think the really important thing in NIST and others working on this is for emerging markets. I mean, Cindy started that. We didn't touch on emerging markets. For those countries that don't have the kind of manpower, I mean, everybody's struggling, but those with less are struggling more. And so the more we do globally at global fora, the more that we have standards out there, it's helpful to all. All right, with that, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much, all three of you. Very different angles, but very interesting.